Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayet. Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Sloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. This morning we're reading from the second chapter, or second canto, excuse me, Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 4, verse 6. Yeah. And this is the subject of creation, as we find in Srimad Bhagavatam. Rather long purport, so we'll get right into this. Let's do the synonyms first, if you don't mind. Okay? Let me just read these together. Booyah.
Booyah.
Let's do them together, huh? Again. Eva. Also. Vishvasami. I wish to learn. Bhagavan. The personality of Godhead. Atma. Personal. Mayaya. By the energies. Yata. As. Idam. This phenomenal world. Srijate. Does create. Vishvam. Universe. Durvi Bhavyam. Inconceivable. Adhishwarai, by the great demigods. Bhuya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Yate dam srijate vishvam. Durvi bhavam adhishwaram. Adhishwarai. Bhuya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Yate dam srijate vishvam. Durvi bhavyam adhishwarai. Please chant. Bhuya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Yate dam srijate vishvam. Bhuya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Yate dam srijate vishvam. Baba Madhishwara.
Bhuya eva vritsami.
Bhuya eva vritsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Itedam vishate vishvam. Durvi bhava madhishwarai. Durya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Ite dam shijate vishvam. Puti bhava madhishwarai. Bhuya eva vivitsami. Bhagavan atma mayaya. Yate dam shijate vishvam. Durvi bhavam adhishwarai. Anyone else? Okay, translation please. This is Maharaj Parikshit asking Sukadev Goswami here at the outset, near the outset of the second canto. You know, they have sat down together at the end of the first canto on the bank of the Ganga, and Sukadeva Goswami begins in the second canto by speaking out very heavily about materialism and then talking about the first steps of God realization. So now Sukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Parikshit asks this question. I beg to know from you how the personality of Godhead by his personal energies creates these phenomenal universes as they are, which are inconceivable even to the great demigods. Okay, so this is a rather long purport, but very pertinent, so who would like to begin?
In every inquisitive mind, the important question of creation of the phenomenal world arises, and therefore, for a personality like Maharaj Parikshit, who has to know all the activities and the Lord of the Lord from his spiritual master, such as inquiry is not uncommon. For every unknown thing, we have to learn and inquire from a learned personality. The question of creation is also one of such inquiries to be made to the right person. The spiritual master, therefore, must be one who is Samajna, as stated here in the
Sarvajna. Sarvajna.
This is Sama.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a misprint on the screen. Okay, Sarvajna means knowing everything.
Makes sense. As stated here and before in connection with Sukadev Goswami, the soul inquiries on God, which are unknown to the disciple, may be made from the qualified spiritual master. And here the practical example is set by Maharaj Parikshit. It is, however, already known to Maharaj Parikshit that everything we see is born out of the energy of the Lord, as we all have learned in the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. Janmadi asya yataha.
What is that verse, anyone know? Referring to?
First verse.
Srimad Bhagavatam. Right. Go ahead.
So Maharaj Parikshit wanted to know the process of creation. The origin of creation was known to him. Otherwise, he would not have inquired how the personality of Godhead, by his different energies, creates this phenomenal world.
The common man also knows that the creation is made by some creator and is not created automatically. We have no experience in the practical world that the thing is created automatically. Foolish people say that the creative energy is independent and acts automatically as electrical energy works. But the intelligent man knows that even the electric energy is generated by an expert engineer in the localized powerhouse, and thus the energy is distributed everywhere under the resident engineer's supervision. The Lord's supervision in connection with creation is mentioned even in the Bhagavad Gita. And it is clearly said there that material energy is a manifestation of one of many such energies of the Supreme. Parasya saktir vividhaiva shruyate. An inexperienced boy may be struck with wonder by seeing the impersonal actions of electronics or many other wonderful things conducted by electrical energy, but an experienced man knows that behind the action is a living man who creates such energy.
Similarly, the so-called scholars and philosophers of the world may by mental speculation present so many utopian theories about the impersonal creation of the universe. But an intelligent devotee of the Lord, by studying the Bhagavad Gita, can know that behind the creation is the hand of the Supreme Lord. Just as in the generating electrical powerhouse, there is the resident engineer. The research scholar finds out the cause and the effect of everything. But research scholars are as great as Brahma, Shiva, Indra, and many other demigods are sometimes bewildered by seeing the wonderful creative energy of the Lord. So what to speak of the tiny mundane scholars dealing in petty things? As there are differences in the living conditions of different planets of the universe, and as one planet is superior to others, the brains of the living entities in those respective planets are also of different categorical values. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, one can compare the long duration of life of the inhabitants of Brahma's planet, which is inconceivable to the inhabitants of this planet Earth, to the categorical value of the brain of Brahmaji, also inconceivable to any great scientist of this planet. And with such high brain power, even Brahmaji has described in his great Samhita as follows.
Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadi Radhya Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam.
There are many personalities possessing the qualities of Bhagavan, but Krishna is the supreme because none can excel him. He is the supreme person and his body is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. He is the primeval Lord Govinda and the cause of all causes. Brahmaji admits Lord Krishna to be the supreme cause of all causes, but persons with tiny brains within this petty planet Earth think of the Lord as one of them. Thus, when the Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita that he, Lord Krishna, is all in all, the speculative philosophers and the mundane wranglers deride him, and the Lord regretfully says,
Abha jananti ma mudha manusim tanam ashritam tam bhavam jananto mama bhuta maheshwara.
Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature and my supreme dominion over all that be. Brahma and Shiva, and what to speak of other demigods, are bhutas, or powerful created demigods who manage universal affairs, much like ministers appointed by a king. The ministers may be Ishvaras, or controllers, but the Supreme Lord is Maheshvara, or the creator of the controllers. Persons with a poor fund of knowledge do not know this, and therefore they have the audacity to deride him because he comes before us by his causeless mercy occasionally as a human being. The Lord is not like a human being. He is Satchitananda Vigraha, or the absolute personality of Godhead, and there is no difference between his body and his soul. He is both the power and the powerful.
Maharaj Parikshit did not ask his spiritual master, Shukadev Goswami, to narrate Lord Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. He wanted to hear first about the creation of the Lord. Shukadev Goswami did not say that the king should hear about the direct transcendental pastimes of the Lord. The time was very short, and naturally, Shukadev Goswami could have gone directly to the 10th canto to make a shortcut of the whole thing, as generally done by the professional reciters. But neither the king nor the great speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam jumped up like the organizers of Bhagavatam. Both of them proceeded systematically, so that both future readers and hearers might take lessons from the example of the procedure of reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. Those who are in control of the external energy of the Lord, or in other words, those who are in the material world, must first of all know how the external energy of the Lord is working under the direction of the Supreme Personality. And afterwards, one may try to enter into the activities of his internal energy. The mundaners are mostly worshippers of Durga Devi, the external energy of Krishna, but they do not know that Durga Devi is but the shadow energy of the Lord. Behind her astonishing display of material workings is the direction of the Lord, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita.
The Brahma Samhita affirms that Durga Shakti is working by the direction of Govinda, and without his sanction, the powerful Durga Shakti cannot move even a blade of grass. Therefore, the neophyte devotee, instead of jumping at once to the platform of transcendental pastimes presented by the eternal energy of the Lord, may know how great the Supreme Lord is by inquiring about the process of his creative energy. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita also, descriptions of the creative energy and the Lord's hand in it are explained. And the author of Chaitanya Charitamrita has warned the neophyte devotees to be seriously on guard against the pitfall of neglecting knowledge about Krishna in regard to how great he is. Only when one knows Lord Krishna's greatness can one firmly put one's unflinching faith in him. Otherwise, like the common man, even the great leaders of men will mistake Lord Krishna for one of the many demigods, or a historical personality, or a myth only. The transcendental pastimes of the Lord in Vrindavan, or even at Dwarka, are relishable for persons who have already qualified themselves in advanced spiritual techniques, and the common man may be able to attain to such a plane by the gradual process of service and inquiries, as we shall see in the behavior of Maharaj Parikshit.
So we're going to go over, thank you very much everyone for reading, we'll go over the what they call the Hindu myth of creation, this morning, which we understand as authoritative knowledge from Srimad Bhagavatam. So before we do, a few words about epistemology. What is epistemology? Yes, the study of knowledge, how we get knowledge, how we get knowledge. So it is critical to understand in spiritual life that, first of all, we don't know everything. And furthermore, that our senses are unable to perceive everything. And that's why we don't know everything. So science means to, at least modern science, means to be able to verify everything sensually. If you can prove it by sensual experience, then it's considered true, otherwise not. So I wanted to preface this section, or this discussion, by telling you a short story. Our friends at the Bhaktivedanta Institute once arranged with a noted scholar, scientist, to study the whole Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita sections on the subject of creation. So the purpose of this exercise was to see what kind of response a scholar who was committed to the scientific methodological study of creation would have in response to this scriptural discussion. So he worked at it very hard and came up with an article which said essentially that nothing in Srimad Bhagavatam, as a scientist, he said, nothing in Srimad Bhagavatam is falsifiable. In other words, he could not disprove anything. He said, as a scientist, I don't believe it because I can't prove it, but nor can I disprove it. So that is an important concept for us to at least grasp approaching the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam. Why? Because we are very steeped and very conditioned and very brainwashed to accept the scientific point of view as absolute. That has been our upbringing from our very childhood. So it's deeply ingrained in us that the high priests of truth in our society are scientists, and they are able to extend the field of their sensual perception through the use of amazing tools like electron microscopes and the Hubble Space Telescope. So they have slightly more knowledge about the phenomenal universe through their sensual perception than does the rest of humanity. And as is the human nature, if you have 2 pennies and someone else has 1, you think yourself quite superior, right? Thank you. So what Srimad Bhagavatam has is very revolutionary knowledge, a completely different epistemology, first of all. The method of acquiring knowledge is not at all dependent on sensual perception, which is called the avaroraha panta, or the ascending path to knowledge. It is rather shabda, or descending knowledge. It is amazingly arrogant to assume that nobody could know these things. We're going to have to find them out for ourselves. Not only arrogant, but really sad, because what can we find out for ourselves? You know, our abilities are so limited. So at least, according to the science, what is coming from shabda is not falsifiable. So as in a movie or as in a good novel, the first step is to suspend disbelief and appreciate, if nothing else, that what we hear from Srimad Bhagavatam is extremely scientific and precise. It's not only scientific, it is consistent. It's in the Gita, in the Bhagavatam, in multiple places. These subjects are discussed in considerable detail. And a lot of the time it just goes, whoop, you know, right over our heads because it's rather technical. But if we study it carefully, we see they're very consistent and exact in these, and looked at from various angles of vision. For example, for the last 3 weeks, we've been reading the Chatur Shloka from Srimad Bhagavatam, or Chatur Shloki from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 4 essential verses of the whole 18,000 verse Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, can anyone tell me what the first one is? Very good. Aham evasam evagre, which means? Okay, I rest my case.
No, the creation,
good. That's it. Yes, Krishna is saying, hey, look, I was around before any of this phenomenal universe, and when it's all destroyed, I'll still be here. And everything you see in the meantime is also me. First. And then the second? Yes. Okay, you're making my case beautifully, all this existence that we see, this phenomenal existence, is Krishna's energy, and he is present in all of it, and at the same time he retains his individuality and personality. Okay, so he also says that whatever you see that is not in relation to me, know that to be my external energy. And finally, he says that anyone who wants to know the absolute truth has to search it up to this point. So very vigorously, the presence of God in creation and in science and in everything that exists is underscored by these four verses. So that is our epistemology, that God exists and that he gives an instruction manual along with the universe. It is not a defective product that has been sent from the factory without a manual how to use it, right? It's all here. So here is a short overview of what the Bhagavatam says on these points. And this is not at all comprehensive by any means, but I want to preface this part also by saying what is unique about Srimad Bhagavatam's explanation of creation. We have a biblical explanation. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Okay, that's considered faith in our society. Then we have the scientific explanation that mostly people consider the Big Bang. That is pretty much the standard, is it not? Right? So that somehow or other, there was a big mass of matter. All the matter in the universe consolidated, and then it exploded. And the reason they believe this, as humorous as it sounds sometimes, is that because they discovered that the universe is always expanding. All the stars and planets, everything is going away. The distances are increasing, right? And this is indicative of an explosion taking place. So, and when that was proven, that gave birth to the Big Bang theory. So they don't know where that mass of matter came from originally, but they believe, they understand this much is happening. So what is different about the Srimad Bhagavatam's explanation? What is unique amongst the faith or the scientific versions that we are essentially in competition with? Yes, that's true. But there's one particular thing here that Srimad Bhagavatam explains that neither of these other theories even touch. And it's just one word. No, God is there in the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. God is the cause. That's also... What's the details? Well, the details. Yeah, but that's more than one word. Who God is, that's also missing. But what? Yes, why? Who said that? All right, yes, very good, Alex. That is the question. Why in the world would God bother to create the heavens and the earth? Or why would there be some big bang, you know? What's the purpose of the whole thing? What is it? Why? It's just such a basic question. So this is what we're going to talk about now, and I don't have this in the PowerPoint, but you all know this philosophy. Let's just talk for a moment. Why does creation take place, according to Srimad Bhagavatam? The desire of the living entities to do what? Yes, to enjoy separately from Krishna. I just read this very nice example from Borijan Prabhu that some responsible parents, loving parents, might build a nice playground for their child in the backyard. And they put a big fence around it so that the child will be safe and can go back and play safely. Right? So in that in that setting, the child thinks, okay, now I am enjoying, and now I am going to, I know everything about this place, right? The child has no knowledge of what's going on behind the fence. The child has no perspective about how he's being cared for by his parents. He's just there enjoying the playground. See? So this is analogous to our position in the material world. We don't have any knowledge about what's going on beyond our sensual perception. But our, as far as we're concerned, it's just here for our enjoyment. Let's live it up. Let's party hard. Okay? So existentially, this is why creation takes place. Because some living entities want to enjoy without God. They want to be able to go in the backyard and forget about the parents, a condition that is only exacerbated by teenage years. You know, and when you have little kids, they think, oh, I've got the best mommy and daddy in the world. And when they're 16, they wish that you lived in another state, two states over preferably. The relationship between the living entity and the creator is paramount. It's fundamental to understanding why the universe exists. Can anyone remember a verse from the Bhagavad Gita that describes this? Apareyam itastvanyam prakritim vidimeparam jiva bhuto mahabaho yatedam daryate jagat. In the seventh chapter of the Gita, Krishna talks about his external energies, which we'll go over in a moment. But then, just after describing them, he says, my superior energy consists of the living beings who are struggling hard with the external energy. And it is the desire of the living entity that drives creation, the desire to be separate from God. Otherwise, God would have no need for the playground in the backyard. The kids are mature, and they're working, and they're responsible. Then why build them a playground? Okay, so briefly, we'll just cover the three Vishnus. This is Krishna's Purusha incarnation. The spiritual sky is so fun. It's like Krishna House. No one ever wants to sleep. But, yeah, so in spite of that, because there are living entities who want to get who want to forget about the party, Krishna lies down as Karna Dakshai Vishnu. Here is a brief description. The Mahavishnu lies down in some part of the spiritual sky by his own free will. Thus he lies on the ocean of Karna, from where he glances over his material nature, and the Mahatattva is at once created. Thus, electrified by the power of the Lord, the material nature at once creates innumerable universes, just as in due course a tree decorates itself with innumerable grown fruits. The seed of the tree is sown by the cultivator, and the tree or creeper in due course becomes manifested with so many fruits. Nothing can take place without a cause. The Karna ocean is therefore called the causal ocean. Karna means causal. So Karna Dakshai Vishnu is Krishna, the big Krishna, big Vishnu, lying on this causal ocean, sleeping, and as he sleeps, innumerable universes come from his pores when he exhales. When he inhales, they all come back in. And then, out they go again. And this is called bhutva bhutva praliyate. The universes are being created and destroyed, and created and destroyed. So the living entities who are all entangled in this are manifest for some incredibly long period of time in various bodies reincarnating, and then for an equally long period of time they go into just into stasis, just inert in the body of Vishnu. And by his glance over the external energy, even though he's sleeping, somehow he glances, and all of the living entities enter the material energy and do their pastimes. So this is the first Purusha. Then the second two Purushas. Mahavishnu again enters every universe as the reservoir of all living entities, Garbhodakshayi Vishnu. From Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, Vishnu expands Kshirodakshayi Vishnu, the super soul of every living entity. What does Garbha mean? It means womb. It means womb, right. Yes. So why is this Vishnu called Garbhodakshayi Vishnu? Well, but specifically.
Isn't the egg of the universe?
More specifically. Garbha means womb. To whom does he give birth?
Brahma.
Brahma, right. So from his navel comes this lotus flower on which Brahma appears. This is within each of these innumerable universes. So Brahma is there as this engineer to give every body their bodies. And that is Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So half the universe is filled with water, and Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is lying on that, and then this lotus flower appears, and Brahma fills up the rest with planets and stars and living entities and their bodies. This is the second phase of these three Vishnus. And then Kshirodakshaya Vishnu is who? Supersoul within the heart of every living entity, right. Just as fire permeates wood, so Krishna is Kshirodakshaya Vishnu permeates his creation. Remember we hear about in these four seed verses about how Krishna is in everything. This is how he does it. He's inside every atom and he's in between every atom as well. Okay? So Krishna is present everywhere through this agency of Kshirodakshaya Vishnu. Let's look a little more closely at the material energy that Krishna creates. Thank you. There are 24 elements. There's different lists, but generally this is how they're divided. 24 elements of the material nature. How many elements are there according to the periodic table? 117 is the latest, right? It's grown by about 20 or 30 in my lifetime. So these elements are description of the elements is considered very primitive by scientists to say, oh, well, there's 24 elements of creation, right? This is just a very unscientific. But in fact, it is very scientific. Let's get the whole list here. So what are the five gross elements? Earth, water, air, fire, and ether, right? Okay, and then? Mind, intelligence, and false ego are the three subtle elements. What are the five sense objects?
Touch, taste, form, smell, and sound.
Right, touch, taste, form, smell, and sound. And five knowledge acquiring senses?
Eyes, ears, nose, touch, and taste.
Right. Well, not taste, but
tongue.
Tongue, right. The five senses themselves. And finally, the five working senses. Right. Okay. So that makes how many? 23. What is the 24th? No? The soul is not a material element. What is? It's listed in various ways, but most frequently it's called pradhan, which means the aggregate of all of these things unmanifested. In other words, it's a big reservoir of material energy, and then they're all subdivided into these categories. So the unmanifested material energy is considered a separate element, a 24th element, pradhan. Okay? Is everyone sufficiently bored or confused? It is unmanifested. In other words, it's potential. Then when the universe comes into being, then all of these other elements are created. Okay. So here are the five gross and subtle elements. Can anyone, any of you scholars, quote this verse from the Bhagavad Gita 7:4? What is earth? It's the first word. Right. Bhumir, apo, nalo, vayu, kam, mano, buddhir, eva, cha, ahankara, tiyame. Bina, Prakriti, Ashtada. These, Krishna says, are my eight separated material energies. What does that word separated mean?
Should I probably give the example of a voice recording? Hmm. He said that right now I'm speaking in the microphone, and later I'll be present by my energy, but there won't be any personal contact with the soul.
Very good.
Separated in the sense that Krishna's desire is not expressed through that energy like it is in the internal energy.
Right. It would not exist were it not for him, but it is not him.
Yeah.
just like we're reading in the second verse of the chapter Shloki. Right. In other words, milk is a separated energy of the cow. Another example is given. The milk would not exist without the cow, but the milk is not the cow. So that's a separated energy. So these eight, Krishna describes, are my separate material energies. So just briefly, let's go through this. There's a science associated with all of these energies. What science would you say would be associated with Earth, for example? Geology. How about water? Right, hydraulics. Chemistry also, it could be in that category. Oceanography. How about air? Aerodynamics, meteorology. How about fire?
Combustion.
How about, yeah, like nuclear energy, nuclear physics. Ether.
Space and time,
you could say. We'll talk about ether in just a moment. Actually, let's talk about it now, because it is a considered an ancient Greek myth that the universe is full of ether. The question is raised, what do radio waves travel through? If space is a vacuum, as science says, and yet they're sending space signals to Mars and back to run the little rover, then what are those radio waves traveling through? But how can they travel through a vacuum?
Space, basically.
This is one definition of ether, but physicists challenge it. That, yeah, there's this ethereal presence in space which conducts radio waves. It's this very subtle energy. These are progressively more subtle energies, by the way, starting with Earth, which is the most gross. So this ether is, today in modern chemistry, is considered some kind of organic compound. That word is used in a different way. And they look back at the ancient Greek definition or the Bhagavatam as something very mythological. But anyway, this very subtle energy that conducts radio waves, that's the idea of ether. Okay, and then what is the science of mind? What is the science of intelligence?
Philosophy.
Philosophy. Yes, philosophy means, yes, the study of life, thinking intellectually. So what is the science of false ego? Yes, Krishna consciousness, spiritual life, yeah, exactly. This is the domain, in other words. This is our study in Srimad Bhagavatam, the study of false ego. And what is false ego?
I am body.
Yes, I am his body. With the moment when the eternal spiritual living being identifies with matter, that's false ego. So that's what bhakti is all about, how to break that false identification and realize our eternal spiritual nature. So that is one of the most pernicious and foundational covering. In fact, it's the very first thing that manifests out of this pradhan, out of this unmanifest energy. When the time factor affects the aggregate material energy, the first thing that comes out is false ego. And that way the living entity can accept this idea, I am this material body. So these are progressively more subtle. The most subtle science of all is Krishna consciousness. And again, it's connected with the why the universe exists. All right, so a few more slides here. Let's just break these down quickly. The five sense objects, first one is sound, and that, of course, is generated from ether. Ether comes into existence, and sound is perceivable. Touch is generated from air. Right? You feel the flow of air on your skin. And also, sound is conducted through air. And shape is generated from fire. Seems a little counterintuitive. But this means light, right? Fire, by the way, is not considered an element on the periodic table. It's considered just the result of combustion of elements. But in the Bhagavatam's description, it is a separate and distinct element. And it includes touch. It includes shape, right, so that you can see. The eyes come into play with fire. And taste comes from water, right? And water also conducts sound. Water has touch. Water has shape. But it also has flavor. And finally, aroma, right, which is generated from earth. And so the earth, as the most gross of these elements, has all of the sensual components. You can see it, you can hear in it, you can feel it, you can see it, and you can also smell it. So, any questions on this?
So if there's pure water, it wouldn't have any smell? The smell
pure, pure water would have no taste?
No, it would have taste.
Oh, but it have no smell.
No,
no smell.
So the, all the smell is different by the solid particles.
Yeah, that's the idea. Okay, yes, Prabhu?
Just that you usually use the word form instead of shape.
Form instead of shape, yeah. It's, yeah, just to make it more clear. So fire has form. All right. Okay, so let's talk about briefly these senses. The five knowledge-acquiring senses, the ears, the skin, the eyes, mouth, and nose. And then the five working senses, the voice, arms, legs, genitals, and anus. So these are the means by which the living entity expresses himself and enjoys himself in the material world through these 10 senses. Yatedam daryate jagat. Sense perception only, and the connecting factor between the living entity, who's now convinced he's this body, and the material energy are these 10 senses. So they're considered elements in the material creation. Any questions on this?
Okay. How would they be different from the elements described before?
They're part of. We're just breaking down the list. Okay, but they are independent elements. That's the point. You need the sense objects and the senses to experience them. So, and that comprises the living entity's playground. What is that called in the 13th chapter of the Gita, by the way, the playground? The chetra, the field of activities for the living entity. These are all the components of that playground, of the field of activities. Okay, so just to conclude here, the pradhan, the aggregate material energy, this is the 24th element. Time is sometimes listed as a separate element because none of this happens until the time factor touches the material energy. So it's sometimes considered. It does not exist in the spiritual world. In fact, the Brahma Samhita poetically says that in Krishna's abode, time is conspicuous by its absence. We experience that sometimes, like on a very nice day or in a big kirtan. You know, you just forget about time, whatever. Time is conspicuous by its absence. For once, I don't have to worry about what time is over, what I have to do next. Da, da, da. We're always under the gun of time, of time pressure, because we have this limited time in this body. And we know it's going to end, so we got to hurry up and enjoy. So that time factor is present only in the material world, not in the spiritual world. And finally, this whole study is known as Sankhya. I just wanted to introduce this word if you don't know it. Sankhya means what? It actually means stock. Stock, it's the basis on which knowledge is produced. And there are various, it's the analytical study of material nature. There are many philosophers who have their own version of this list of items. So some Sankhya philosophers would say there's 25 elements or 22 or whatever. But that's right. Okay, so that is the Rush Limbaugh branch of our... Okay. Yes, Krishna Kripa Prabhu. Can we pass the mic up here? Can we pass the microphone, please?
When Krishna's talking to Uddhava in the 11th canto, Uddhava says, well, some people say there's this many, some people say there's that many, some people say there's this many. So he asks Krishna, and Krishna says, yes, I accept all of these, because it just depends on how you break them up. You can divide them up in many ways.
Yes.
So there's no need to fight over.
Okay, very good. All right, any other questions about any of this subject? So here are some concluding words from the Bhagavad Gita. Whoever knows me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead without doubting is the knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in full devotional service to me, O son of Bharata. And on a related note, from the end of the 10th chapter. And the 10th chapter is where Krishna describes all of his opulences. He, among fish, he's the shark. Among men, he is the monarch. All these beautiful analogies. So at the end of all of this, he says, know that all opulent, beautiful, or glorious creations spring but from a spark of my splendor. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. Again, once again, we see pervading and supporting. So the subject that we just covered now is rather technical. Some of you will find it very interesting and delve into it. Like read the 5th chapter of the Adi Leela of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's a very detailed explanation. And in Brahma Samhita and elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, many, many, like in the 3rd canto, the whole creation of time from the atom is very technical on all of these points. And some of you will find it very boring and will not study it in great detail. And that's fine. See, I mentioned these two verses at the end because if you understand the conclusion of it all, then it's understood you have the prerequisites already sufficiently covered. And it is sufficient to just hear it, to understand the epistemology, that we're getting this information from higher sources. Now, how can we trust such fantastic things like Brahma growing androgynously out of the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu? Right. You know, give me the Hubble Space Telescope any day. Yeah. But yet very sane and somewhat reasonable people believe this very easily. And we have, like, have no question about it, no doubt about it. How is that possible? Cannot see Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, right? No, he has not yet been discovered by the Martian space rover. No. So how could we sensibly believe in it without just being like Luddites, like technologically backwards people who are religious fanatics? Anyone care to venture an answer on that? Somebody with the mic.
Okay. Prabhupada would just argue that you also haven't experienced the tests of the scientists. Mm. So either you hear from the scientists and accept what they say, or you hear from the Bhagavatam and accept what it says, but you can't actually experience yourself. So mm-hmm. There has to be some faith there.
Well, that's a very good point. This is the point. That science has convinced us to accept them on faith, right? For example, has anyone seen an electron, but we all believe they exist, right? Has anyone seen the supernovas in space, but we accept that they exist? So many things that we take as a matter of faith because we're conditioned to do so. So the things that the scientists present are just as fantastic, more fantastic, that monkeys somehow morphed into human beings. You know, a fantastic theory that, you know, is completely unprovable. I mean, we don't see any half monkey, half human, you know, that shows that. And we don't see it happening now also, in spite of the peppered moth or whatever it is that apparently changes color. So anyway, my point is that there is faith in either one. Either school of thought. And secondly, in both schools of thought, people accept fantastic things they can't believe. I'm sorry, I'm getting a call from the scientists complaining here. In both cases, we're able to accept fantastic things that we can't believe because there are some things that we can believe and we can experience directly from both schools. Like, for example, in school in science, Copernicus concluded that the Earth was not the center of the universe as was previously thought. But actually, it's one of several planets rotating around the sun. So the Catholic Church, who at the time was upheld the epitome of knowledge, had him. I think he was killed ultimately, wasn't he, or at least persecuted, and Galileo similarly. So the point is that we can now see that is very true. that the earth is rotating around the sun, which also, as Brahmacharya mentioned on Friday, is the Bhagavatam's version as well, but there's more. But by the same token, in Krishna consciousness, we can experience that so many counterintuitive things, that if we stop having gross sense gratification, we'll be happier. You know, go try to tell people that on Turlington Plaza, right? That, yeah, just give up sex life or control your sex life and you'll be a lot happier than you are what you're doing presently. Right? Just stop getting intoxicated and then you can be high all the time. Right? So these things are counterintuitive, but because we have been at least open-minded enough to experiment with them, then we can say, wow, this really works, right? To at least some extent, we have experienced a lot of blissfulness and ecstasy in Krishna consciousness. So that is also a basis for taking other things that we cannot directly experience. Like, how many people here have been to China? No one in the room has been to China. Now, is anyone here who doubts that China exists? other than Jagannath? Okay, so why do we accept that China exists? Because it's because it's Chinese food. Essentially because other people that we believe have been there and testify, yes, there is such a place. Okay. All right. I hope this was helpful. Any comments or questions before we wrap up? Yes, Laura? Right. That is not a question that can be answered before breakfast, I'm afraid. On Friday, Laura, we discussed cosmology a little bit, but it is a very difficult subject because we cannot be as precise as science would like us to be. Right? On the plane of the universe, stars are all, and planets are all rotating and around each other, geocentric. Brahmacharya was explaining these geocentric. If you view it from space, from Earth, they would be these concentric circles. Anyway, it's more than I can explain well at all. But we will conclude with that. I hope you found this useful in at least getting a basic understanding of why the Bhagavatam can be seen as scientific and reasonably so.